And as was already pointed out, I'm the principal investigator of a project entitled The London Moment, and which discusses the lives, interactions and cooperations of exile governments, activists and academics in London during the Second World War. And I think we share a lot of, even though my project is a historian's project and we're all historians working in this on this project, So even though we're all historians, we're delighted to be in this discussion because I think we share a lot of interests. We talk, well, not only the address books, but also talking about space, talking about exile, redefining exile in history, and also looking at local events. So how you can see the local representations and of global events, such as in our case, the Second World War. And in our project groups, there's currently four of us. There's me working on governments in exile in London, and there was already the long list. So we have Belgium, Czechoslovakia, Greece, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, and Yugoslavia, and Free France represented in London. Then there's a PhD student named Sarah Weidner, who works on academic exiles in London as a safe harbor for academic refugees. And there's another PhD student called Simeon Marty, who works on how anti-colonial movements gained a new thrive by this condensation of political power in London during the Second World War. And finally, we have a student assistant named Konstantinos Tsakmaklis, who is currently working or assisting us to read sources on the Yugoslav and Greek governments. And so all historians, and with a different approach, looking at events and developments very similar to those you're looking at. And so today I'm going to talk about address books and address books in exile in wartime London. And address books are particularly important to exiles, as they have two functions as one. On the one hand, they are a portable connection to home and a proof of the process of integration. So you can have both the addresses of your former contacts or of contacts that come with you to into exile, and you can add new addresses, new contacts, and build up a network in place. It enables the emigres to locate old acquaintances in the new country, and it supports their aim to build up new contacts and new networks. And this was particularly true for European exiles during the Second World War in London. They were all far from their occupied home countries, occupied by Nazi Germany. They were living in a city mostly unknown to them. Some knew London before, mostly from international exchange or personal work experience, but to most of them it was largely unknown, and they spoke a different and to many new language. They had left their old lives behind, in many cases also their old friends, family and work environment. And address books, formerly just a tool of daily routine, now became an essential accessory to help build up new networks and to help navigate this new microcosm of exile. And establishing new contacts was essential and really central to this new life. Then they needed their compatriots, co-exiles, if you will, to strengthen their national position, to strengthen national committees, to maintain some communication to their home countries, and to ensure their efficient representation. Then they needed contacts to the British government and the British ministries to secure their own status, to lobby for privileges for themselves, for their national representation, and for their political agendas. And last but not least, they also needed contacts to the other Europeans in London and in the wider UK, to discuss shared experience of exile with kindred spirits, to get advice, to forge alliances, and to plan a new European post-war future. So for all this, they needed contacts, they needed networks, and these could be enabled and facilitated and navigated with address books. This is just to give you a short impression of an Allied microcosm in London, and was the map from 1940 where I put down some little flags of where the offices of the Governments in Exile were situated in central London. And you can see how important space was to the Governments in Exile, which is what I'm mostly talking about today. When you see how much effort they tried to put into having offices located very closely to another and very close to British centers of power. And this is a small map showing the addresses of the services of the of all the offices of the Belgian Government in Exile. And we can see that this is a very good example. The Belgians were very successful in securing offices very close to one another. You can see here on, maybe you see my cursor, I don't know. You can see here that they're mostly situated around Eaton Square and Belgrave Square. And this, of course, had the advantage of very short ways they could visit each other even in and exchange work and documents, even when wartime prevented the tubes from running, or even when a telephone service was interrupted. So being close to one another had important advantages, but of course they also needed to navigate the wider microcosm of London. There were private address books, and I'm going to talk briefly about them later, but there was also even an Allied directory, if you will, an official address book entitled The Who's Who of the Allied Governments in Great Britain, which catered to this new niche of so many exiles needing addresses, of changing their addresses repeatedly because of the war, because of the bombing, because of being refugees, but also to encourage this cooperation. And this is a series which has been published from 1941 to 1944. Listing addresses and short biographies and the most important names for all the members of the Government in Exiles. The first edition was about 80 pages. It grew to about 200 pages, but containing a lot of information about the different governments, but also advertisement, which probably helped financing this brochure, which was very likely free of charge. And all these volumes listed addresses and phone numbers, and it was extreme, but also these biographical sketches. And it was extremely important in this microcosm of exiles, because since they were all refugees and all had all uprooted their former life to come to London, it was not so easy to detect the right addressee amongst other exiles. Who should you talk to with what kind of interest? And so the Who's Who served, if you will, as a white and yellow pages of exile. But while at the same time also providing a list of merits and qualification of Allied curriculum vitae. So, and this had the advantage of being available, potentially available to everyone, not just the exiles, and thus broadened their visibility and accessibility of people and addresses. So this Who's Who basically served three functions. It materialized contacts by containing knowledge in a material brochure. Then secondly, it became integral to Allied networks because of all the information contained within it. And thirdly, it was instrumental in structuring the networks because it determined who was visible and who wasn't. For example, this was a directory of the Allied governments in exile, while at the same time there were national representations from other countries, such as Austria, Denmark, which were not Allied and thus not included and less visible. So, and we can see in how far it was at the same time a representation of connections and and networks, and it was shaping these networks at the same time. Similar things can be said for personal address books, although of course they function slightly differently. Well, first of all, they were not public. They were the address books and address collections of individuals. And this is these are two pages from address books owned by René Cassin, who is mostly known for receiving a Nobel Prize for his participation and co-authorship in the Human Rights Declaration, but during the Second World War was a member of the French National Committee and was their was responsible for legal and educational affairs. And we can see it contains telephone numbers and addresses, though not always both for every entry. It was actually a very, he had very small address books. I can't really tell the size here, but they're quite tiny, so you could fit them in any pocket and take them along. Clearly an object of daily use. And there's entries with different pens and even a different handwriting. So it might be that sometimes his secretary added entries on her own. And sometimes, interestingly, we will find a lot of names we would expect, but others are not included, and we cannot tell why. So were members of the Free French of the other Free French cabinet members, for example, not included because daily contact had made it unnecessary to list their phone numbers, or whether their phone numbers were known by heart, or because he wasn't that closely in touch. But on the other hand, we do find numbers for other members of cabinet, and including multiple entries for the Cabinet du Général, so General de Gaulle, and who obviously changed address and phone numbers a couple of times. Cassin also owns two address books. With these are just updated, but there's a second parallel address book for addresses in Alger, because at some point the French committee split and some of the representatives were based in Alger. My second example I brought along is by Edward Raczynski, who was the Polish ambassador already before, but also during the time of the war. Unfortunately, I couldn't photograph his address book. So these are photographs of a reception book of the Polish embassy during the war. He has two, but which also adds to the same function of collecting addresses and contacts. So his address books as well were very small, obviously objects of daily use, filled with his own handwriting, cover the pre-war and war years. And so they list mainly London addresses, but also addresses from Paris, Warsaw, Geneva, and Berlin. And most have phone numbers, amongst them Winston Churchill's, several numbers for the Foreign Office, but also clubs and hotels, for example, the Claridge's, and a couple of postal addresses. And most interestingly, Raczynski also uses his address book to make notes about when he met with someone or what they could be of help with. For example, who is the right contact for passports as the French consulate, or the director of intelligence at Reuters office, the Times correspondents for certain cities, who came over, who had been over for dinner before, similar details. For some people, he lists a personal of both the office address and the personal address, or where they would spend their holidays. His address book, Raczynski's address book, also lists very official phone numbers, such as phone numbers for Buckingham Palace, the Foreign Office, the Home Office, the House of Lords, the Stationery Office, and the Treasury, but also for important liaison offices and the BBC for communication. So address book, what I want to do with address book, or what I do in my book with address books, is to talk about how they become an important part of the network, because these networks could not be maintained without them. And very unfortunately, as this fits in perfectly with what you said about sources, our problem is that in many cases, address books did not survive in the private papers and collections of people, perhaps because they were considered as common household objects, perhaps because the quality of paper in wartime meant that they were not very durable. Or maybe in this particular case of exiled address books, also because their owners, when returning from exile, decided that luggage space could be used in a better way than transporting address books containing addresses that were no longer relevant. Additionally, families, heirs, and archivists often regarded address books as less important to keep for posterity or for analyzing for historical research than, for example, letters or diaries. This, of course, has changed, in particular over the last decade or so, when both the impact of space and the impact of cultural approaches, also with regard to diplomatic and political exile, were considered more and more important. So what we can see when we look at Cassin's and Wroczynski's address books is that both speak of their ability as networkers and brokers in the London microcosm. And this is, in a way, their address books show their capital. Again, collecting these addresses was their capital to navigate a social network. At the same time, the printed directory, the who's who of the Allied governments, shows a more democratized insider knowledge because it was potentially available to anyone. And Karl Schlögel's quote, a historian who worked a lot with space, fits in quite neatly when he talks about address books with regard to Berlin and St. Petersburg and Moscow, talking about that address books are inventories of social history, navigation books through the networks of individual relations. And I think this fits in fits in very well with my point today. And by following the listed addresses and the noted meeting places, we can reconstruct who met whom and discover daily life and social conditions of intellectual and political cooperation and link practices in everyday life to a broader history of idea and diplomatic and political history. The address book, to my view, also serves as an object in Bruno Latour's understanding of delegation, as it can store information which would otherwise go beyond the capacity of personal memory and thus becomes an integral part of a network. And so this is my main point, which I would love to discuss with you. So the agency, if you will, of address books and directories was crucial in managing and governing urban space and to construct and maintain networks in wartime London. And of course, they also enabled me to draw this map because the map was it was just blank before. You could see London in wartime, but having all these addresses helped me to show you this London microcosm. And in a second phase of the London Moment project, which just got granted, and when the project will move to the universities of Bamberg and Bayreuth, we will also try to transfer this into a GIS analysis and make these maps available to a broader public.